He sent me a part of a postcard made out of wood. Redwood postcard that a fourth of it didn't make it. It's all broken up. Thought that counts. Brother Larry? Actually, the earth we see is a part of God's destruction. The flood. Now, it's pretty enough. When he destroys something, he makes it pretty. What's it going to be like if he doesn't destroy it? Makes it out of it. Creates it. Yeah. California sent me pictures of sand, grains of sand multiplied over. Man, you would have never thought it was grains of sand. The pictures is just phenomenal. Magnified, yeah, I don't know how many times. You would have never guessed it was sand after looking at all the different colors and everything. Just phenomenal. Well, I'm saving your email box from being about getting 5 emails every day. Yeah, he loads the email box. He loads the email box with all these fundamentalists because I see his email list, and he does it just to tweak them. He just loves tweaking these guys. Yes, ma'am. House, and he was so scared to death when he got out of there, the cops showed up and he surrendered immediately, and they said, why'd you surrender? Well, it was a black lady that lived in a house, and she was an Acts 2:38 fan, and she says, Jesus help me, Acts 2:38, and he thought she had an axe in 2:38, so scared to death. Oh well, okay, 2 Samuel 1. Got down to 17. 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, sometimes called 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Kings. 2nd Samuel is about the kingdom of David. Most of that's what it's about. And then in 1st Kings it gets into Solomon. And in 2 Samuel 1:17, we see an aspect about David that qualified him to be a man after God's own heart. And let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand these words. Help us to imagine being in the position of David as he ran for his life as a fugitive, hiding, wondering if he was going to live another day. And often getting caught or trapped, and yet you getting him out of it. And even his life was attempted to be taken from him twice by this man. And then this man dies, and we see his reaction to it. He doesn't want to dance on his grave. He brags about the man. And I guess David had a thought process that was much deeper than most. And I pray that you'd help us to think like him. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, 2 Samuel 1:17. Saul has died in the previous chapter of chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. And a young Amalekite tried taking credit for the death, which Saul actually took his own life. But the Amalekite gave an admission that he took his life, even though he didn't. And David went on the admission, because admission trumps evidence, and the man suffered the death sentence. Now we have a funeral here in verse 17, and we have David lamenting, the dead parties. So he's got one man and three sons. So this is a quite extensive funeral. He only mentions the one son that he was close to. I've been at a few funerals through the year. Probably the most I saw was one where there were five people dead, but there were a father, a young fella, shot his wife and child, killed them, a child I think 5 years old, and then he went home and shot his father and mother. And so they had the father, the mother, and him, and then he shot himself at one funeral home, and the wife and child at another funeral home. And it was his brother was a friend of mine in high school, and a weird situation happened just out here toward out by Lake Prairie several years ago. And so that was the worst one I've seen. You've got Job, where he had 10 in that one funeral. So this one you have 4, but he mentions 2 of them. And you can see how the word lamented in verse 17 with lamentation. Okay, that gives us our definition of that term, and so that helps us to understand the little book called Lamentations after Jeremiah. Jeremiah wrote 52 chapters in Jeremiah, and then you add 5 more of that little book called Lamentations. He's lamenting over the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. It's understandable why he would lament over Jonathan. That was his good friend. But what about Saul? You would tend to think the natural human reaction is dance on his grave. As I heard a lady say one time, the only thing she regrets about the death of her stepfather is that she couldn't dance on his grave. Okay, and so this is the other side of David. This is the forgiveness side. Okay, and you have some men in the Bible that God used as great examples. Joseph is a fellow who is in type portraying Jesus Christ probably more than anybody. And Joseph forgave his 10 brothers for selling him into slavery. And how much has his life changed where he did not, all that lost time with his dad and with his younger brother Benjamin. And the boys, when daddy eventually did die, they said, hey, dad wants us to tell you to forgive us. And he'd already done that anyway. Now, in his case, He obviously had time, okay, and time often does heal, and forgiveness is not as tough, but where did he actually forgive them in there? Nobody knows. Joseph is a type of Christ. You have another man, Daniel, is in type of picture of the Holy Ghost, Daniel 5, and he shows no bitterness at all of the death of his parents when Nebuchadnezzar and the army came in, and he shows no bitterness toward Nebuchadnezzar, and he shows no bitterness for castrating him and taking away his opportunity to have a child. There's no bitterness recorded in Daniel at all about this. Maybe he had sleepless nights. Maybe he had to deal with it himself. But there's no record of it. He portrays the Spirit of God. David himself is a man who lived his life on the run as a fugitive. Didn't know if he was going to survive anything. And when the man that was came after him multiple times, multiple occasions, when he's dead, David does not rejoice over it. So this is the forgiveness that these men demonstrate. Verse 18 in the parentheses, he just the writer Samuel just throws in a thought there where he says this: as he bade them teach the children of Israel, Judah, the use of the bow, behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. Now, some of our folks that are looking for hidden wisdom are probably still looking for that book. Maybe they found it and thinks it's supposed to be in the Bible. Just because it's mentioned by the Bible itself doesn't mean it's supposed to be in the Bible. This book of Jasher was also mentioned back in Joshua. It is just as much the inspiration of God not to include something as it is to include it. Now, some folks may be busy about looking for this one or the book of Enoch or the book of the Gospel according to Thomas or the Epistle of Barnabas or the apocryphal books. They haven't even figured out 66. Why add a bunch more? Okay, and so it's the idea is they're looking for hidden wisdom, and this is the same temptation that the Illuminati has, saying that they've got a hidden wisdom, and this takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 when the serpent promised Eve that she would get some hidden wisdom to think like God. Nothing has changed in that. So just because it mentions the book of Jasher may be a good historical book if they ever did find it, or maybe they have found it, but it's not something that God wanted to put place in the Bible under the inspiration of God. So now here's David's comments about Saul and Jonathan. Verse 19, the beauty of Israel is slain. Upon the high places, how are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Well, that's too late for that, because they've already known it. They already had pinned his body up. Okay, but he doesn't want it. He doesn't want the world to rejoice about this. Verse 21, he says, "Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty." Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives. That's quite a comment about a man that tried to pin him against the wall, isn't it? He could overlook that and look at the big picture. Look at the entire picture. I'm certainly glad that God is like that. Later on, when he comments about David, he just says that David had a heart perfect right with God, except in the matter of Uriah. That's the only thing he brought up. And when you go into the Hebrews, in Hebrews 11, and you read the comments about Old Testament saints, he seems to forget all that he wrote about their faults and their sins. You see, the Lord God looks at the entire picture. He's not going to take this time where we botch it or this time where we botch it. Now, if we botched it a lot, he might bring it up. But the Lord looks at the big picture, and so must we look at the big picture. Look at what people have done, the large picture. Now, Americans are so spoiled. If somebody didn't get their way on this issue or this issue, you know, all that stuff, then they're going to gripe about that issue. Okay, if you agree with somebody 9 out of 10 times, you should have no problem. 8 out of 10 times, you should have no problem. 7 out of 10 times, you should have no problem. If you're going to always pick on that one disagreement, that's a sign of immaturity. You know, you go to a church where maybe you know automatically you don't agree with some things in there. Okay, if you knew that from the start, then keep your mouth shut. If you're going to approach a pastor or somebody, if he's older than you, the Bible forbids you to rebuke them and tell them your vast wisdom and your vast Bible knowledge. 1 Peter 5, verse 1 says, entreat them as a father. Rebuke not the elders, but entreat them as a father. It's sad that our culture is very lax on that. Somebody older than you, you have no right to chew them out. And this is something that a person has to be very careful. If you're like a foreman on a job, you get somebody older than you, you got to deal with them very gently. Okay, the Chinese or the Oriental culture, they're very strict on these things. And of course, the Bible is an Oriental book. So, hey, if you got a disagreement with somebody, and if it's not a big deal, forget it. Look at the big picture. I've seen people, even in this church through the years, get a burr under their saddle, and they get mad about one or two issues, and they get mad and they burn their bridges, and they go to another church where right off the bat they've got five disagreements. Where they left one where they had two, but because they burned their bridges and made a fool out of themselves about the two, they'll stick there with the five and they won't come back because of the two. And so, immaturity. Okay, immaturity. There's no problem with, you know, we're not going to agree 100%. None of us are going to agree. I don't agree with myself half the time, it seems like. You know, and so that's just life. And so here David is looking at Saul's life, and he says, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives. And in their death, they were not divided. One of the biggest ones that I think are some of the funniest things is these professional athletes that get paid millions of dollars and they don't get their way, they're mad at their sports team and they go find something else. Live high in the hog and low in the chicken and they're griping them because they didn't get their way. But that's the American mindset these days. It's a very sad thing, and that's come into the church. So he says, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives. And in their death, they were not divided. Now, we know what Jonathan felt about David. We know what Saul felt about David. But yet, evidently, on one occasion it came up where Saul even threw a javelin at Jonathan. But they could put that behind them. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. Now, technically, very precisely, he did not. Okay, no king can do that unless they take it from somebody else. And actually, what you want a king or a government to do is get out of the stinking way and let the productive people provide for their own. That's the best thing that they could do. But yet, evidently, Saul did provide an economic atmosphere so that the people could clothe themselves with scarlet. And they could do that. And yet, he gets the credit for it, which is rightfully so. Okay, but the key is get out of the way and do these things. So he's encouraging the people of Israel, weep over Saul. Now, of course, we know how the news media will write that. The world is in mourning because Saul died. No, the vast majority of the world didn't even know he existed. You know, and JFK gets shot. America is in mourning. No, the vast majority of Americans could care less. They really don't care. You know, and so, but yet that's how, that's, you know, that's PR talk is what that is. Put the flags at half mast, and then people walk around. What are they doing that for? Who died? They don't know half the time. That's all news media talk. So then he says this, 25, how are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Now, of course, the perverted mindset of San Francisco, you know how they're going to think about that. That's because their mind is in a gutter. Okay, this is a friend. This is the best of friend that he's ever had. And so he's obviously broken about this. Verse 27, how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? Okay, now a person could read that and say, okay, that's good what he said publicly. That's how he really felt. You know, that's not, may not be how he really felt. But David has already demonstrated how he really did feel. Okay, and he's going to demonstrate it more. So this is not, from David's perspective, this is not just talk. A lot of times you hear people say these things, they were just talk. LBJ probably at JFK's funeral talked about, oh, how wonderful he was a president. And LBJ hated JFK's guts. They hated each other. I mean, I remember reading a biography about that at Grace College in the history class. We were told to read his biography, and it was about LBJ's hatred for JFK. And the only reason he got him, because he had helped him swing the election his way. And they just despised each other. Okay, but this is not the case with David and Saul. These are sincere words being expressed by him. And how we know that is because of his actions. Our actions speak louder than words, and his actions will demonstrate. Chapter 2, verse 1, it came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said unto him, go up. And David said, whither shall I go up? And he said unto, now we say Hebron, they would say Hebron. Now notice David is a king. He is the king, but he is not coming in as a forceful monarch getting his way. He is a very unusual type of king. He wants people to voluntarily get under his authority, his monarchy. So he's not forcing it. He's asking the Lord, what do I do? Now the Lord is answering him through the Urim and Thummim. Okay, that's that breastplate where the priest had, and it had the 12 stones on there. And when he asked the Lord these things, the stones would light up, give him the answer. So it was a direct line right into the throne of God, right into the mind of God. So he knew exactly. Now that would be nice to have something like that if you're going to buy some property or buy a house or something like that. That'd be nice. Okay, but we don't have that benefit. So he's telling him to go to Hebron. Now he's in the cities of Judah. That's the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin. Benjamin was on the side of Saul, so he's actually only in one tribe right now. He is not forcing himself into this position. Even though he has God's authority, he's not forcing it. So he's going to Hebron. And so it says, so David went up thither, and his two wives also, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, Nabal's wife, the Carmelite. Now notice, he still calls her Nabal's wife. Nabal's dead. So he's just giving us the idea. That's who it is. Verse 3, and his men that were with him, did David bring up? Okay, so you got David's mighty men, the 600, that, and all their families. So now they're all settling in Hebron. Every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Not all 12 tribes yet, just one tribe. And they told David, saying, that the men of Jabesh Gilead were they that buried Saul. Now, I don't know why they told him this. I don't know what their motive is for telling this. If their motive is that they wanted to get in his good graces, thinking that David's going to go after these guys, well, no doubt he's going to surprise them if that's what they think. Now, here is the actions of David showing that his words were sincere of the previous chapter. These were the ones that rescued the body, took the body of Saul and the body of Jonathan as two brothers. And David is going to commend them for their actions. If he did not forgive Saul, he would not be doing this. Verse 5, and David sent messengers unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said unto them, Blessed be ye of the Lord, that ye have showed this kindness unto your Lord, even unto Saul, and have buried him. And now the Lord show kindness and truth unto you, and I also will requite you this kindness because ye have done this. And I'll bet you in their mind they're thinking, is he serious? This is not normal behavior. What's the first thing a revolutionary does when he comes in charge of a nation, like Castro? He kills all the revolutionaries with them. Because if they revolted against the established authority, they're going to revolt against him. That's common. Well, no doubt they're scratching their head on this one. This is not normal behavior. This is why David is a man after God's own heart. 7. Therefore, now let your hands be strengthened, and be ye valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. But Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. Now, why is this guy doing this? Does he think that Ishbosheth has a better talent to be king? Does he admire this guy? Does he want to be under his kingship? I highly doubt it. Abner is doing this because he sees that his position is being lost, and he really doesn't like this guy as much as he doesn't like David. So he's promoting this guy just so that he could be number two guy. And in Jude verse 16 it says, And some having admiration because of advantage. Sadly, in a lot of churches, you know, if somebody comes in or somebody's trying to do an insurrection, they say, well, so-and-so should actually, you know, be in charge or whatnot. That person really don't admire so-and-so. It's just that they want them to be somebody that they can control. You know, and usually when you have a trouble in a church, and no matter how much it is, if it's a big split, you can boil it down to one or two people. That's really where you can boil it down, and usually a husband and wife. No matter how big it is, how little it is, that's what you can usually boil it right down to. You just weed it through, wait it out, come through, and then wait for the colors to be shown and manifest, and that's how it's worked. Now, you see, this is not my church. You know, I am not the final authority in this place. This book is the final authority. And if the Lord likes what's going on, then the Lord's going to support it. If the Lord doesn't like what's going on, then what are you and I going to do about it? If He writes Ichabod in the door, we ought to hightail it out of here. Okay, and so you can't really tell, you know, on some of those things. So just relax and let the Lord run the thing. We say that we want the Spirit to move and lead. Well, we need to let Him do it. A lot of these charismatic churches that really manifest that. If you ever take a vacation, go to a charismatic church for some entertainment. And if they happen to say, you know, the Spirit is leading, get into the Spirit. Let Him lead you. Walk right up to the front and say, the Lord is leading me to give this testimony. You know, tell them the Bible is a great blessing to me. If you would, turn in your Bible to this passage, and when it's missing, let the Spirit work on them for a while. Another verse is a great verse. It's a real blessing to me. Would you read it with me? And they turn in their NIV, and it's not there. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, if the Spirit's leading, have some fun with it. I mean, if that's what they really believe. Now, I know they don't. But, you know, when you take vacations, you know, see what's out there. Some folks need to expand their horizon. I remember one year we was down, our family was down in Florida. We went to a black church. And when they introduced the visitors, they obviously said, we are the church of the open door. And I knew who they were talking to. And it was a blessing. I got a blessing out of it, even though they had Jesse Jackson coming next month. But, oh well, that's how it goes. But you talk about friendly? They were friendly. Of course, we stuck out like sore thumbs. And they knew who the visitors were. But they were friendly. And so take those opportunities. Use those opportunities. If your children have only sat in this church, teenagers have only sat in this church or church like it, on your trips, expand their horizon. Use it as a field trip. Show them. Man, did you hear that guy say one Bible verse? Man, look at that music. Man, isn't this something? Take him to a Catholic church. Stand up, sit down. Stand up, sit down. Stand up, sit down. Sit down, stand up. You know, just to see what it's like. That's how you could really see what's the heartbeats going on. Okay, but here we have Abner. He is promoting Ishbosheth. Not because he thinks he's going to be a great king. He is promoting him because he thinks he can get his second position back. Verse 9, and made him king over Gilead. He did it. And over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, and over all Israel. So he did it. But you see, he doesn't have God's backing on it. Verse 10, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. Now this is not normal behavior. Normally, a king like David would have attacked him, boom, like that. Would have gone after him. Dispelled this rebellion. No, he just let it ride. Let it ride. The house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Boy, a lot of patience there. Verse 12, and Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down, and one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, now these are two men jockeying for military position. Joab is going to be the general under David, and Abner is the general under Ishbosheth. So they are rivals. And so Abner said to Joab, let the young men now arise and play before us. Now those Orientals play differently than we play. You know, the Europeans play and take their soccer much more serious than Americans take basketball, you know, and hockey and football. I mean, over there, their team loses, they trample people to death. They get fired up. Down in Colombia, the one guy that lost, you know, that one World Cup in the past, I don't forget, when he got back to Colombia, they took him out. I mean, they take their sports seriously in those places. You know, but there he is. Now, they're going to have a friendly contest, you know, capture the flag. And it gets serious. Joab said, let them arise. Then there arose and went over by number the 12 of Benjamin, which pertained to Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And they caught every one his fellow by the head and thrust his sword in his fellow's side, so that they fell down together. Wherefore that place was called, whatever that is, which is in Gibeon. Their capture the flag drew real blood. Somebody died in this one. Verse 17, it got so bad and there was a very sore battle that day. And Abner was beaten and the men of Israel before the servants of David. So here this friendly contest took on a serious means. Okay, so Abner was wanting to obviously to use this to, you know, nip at the heels of Joab, and he lost. So he's mad. Verse 18, and there were three sons of Zeruiah there, Joab, and Abishai, and Ahasahel. Okay, and Hazael was light of foot as a wild roe, so he's a fast, very fast runner. Hazael pursued after Abner, and in going he turned not to right hand nor to left hand from following Abner. And then Abner looked behind him and said, "Art thou Hazael?" And he said, "I am." And Abner said unto him, "Turn thee aside to thy right hand or thy left hand, lay thee hold on one of the young men and take thee his armor." But Hazael would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Hazael, "Turn thee aside from following me. Wherefore should I smite thee to the ground? How then should I hold up my face at Joab thy brother? Howbeit it refused to turn aside. Wherefore Abner with the hinder end of the spear smote him under the fifth rib, that the spear came out behind him, and he fell down there and died in the same place. And it came to pass that as many as came to the place where Hazael fell down and died stood still." So it's like he's running, and he knew right where he's at behind him, and this guy wasn't a military experience. And Abner just kind of sidestepped it and let the spear come back this way and hit him under the fifth rib. And that's a common thing in the Bible. When it talks about that fifth rib coming in there, that means they're going to die. The fifth rib, the number five, that's probably where the Lord was stabbed, coming in under that fifth rib. So this is Joab's brother. Now we're going to see that Joab wants vengeance. He killed my brother. Verse 24, Joab also and Abishai pursued after Abner, and the sun went down when they were come to the hill of Ammah that lies before Gibeah by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the children of Benjamin gathered themselves together after Abner and became one troop and stood on top of a hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Knowest thou not that it will be bitterness in the latter end? How long will it be then, ere thou bid the people return from following their brethren?" Joab said, "As God liveth," it's an oath he's making, "unless thou hast spoken, surely then in the morning the people had gone up, everyone from following his brother." So Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and pursued after Israel no more, neither fought they any more. Stop the battle. Joab's going to wait for his timing. And Abner and his men walked all that night through the plain and passed over Jordan and went through all Bithron, and they came to Mahanaim. And Joab returned from following Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there lacked of David's servants 19 men and Hazael. That's when Joab found out about it. But the servants of David had smitten of Benjamin and of Abner's men, so that 300 and 60 men died. 360. Boy, what a contest. And then they took up Hazael and buried him in the sepulcher of his father, which is in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at the break of day. Now at that point, we know that Joab's going to get even. And he eventually does. Okay, so that's chapter 2. Any questions or comments when we covered?